This is Amy Rubin from the Samuel Proctor Oral History Program at the University of Florida. Today I will be interviewing Dr. Gerhard Freund. The date is March 15th and the time is 1:45 p.m. This interview is taking place at the home of Dr. Freund. Can you tell me about your early childhood?
Well, I was born in Germany. And I remember vividly that I asked my father, I admired this beautiful flag that was a communist flag with hammer and sickle. And I admired that flag and said, "Dad, could we please buy one of those flags?" And my father was shocked, and he said, "Oh no, we won't. We don't believe in the communist faith because they don't have any faith." And so the my introduction to the world was to communism, and my father was actually a government official, and he didn't want to emphasize the fact that we are in Germany, and so he said that he didn't want me to have a flag like that. So that was my introduction to when I was born, and I was grew up in Germany, and I went to school there, and I guess I had a pretty much normal school, normal upbringing.
What was your family like?
My family, I was an only child, and my father was, my father and my mother were true Christians, and they brought me up like a Christian child and took me to a church. And I remember my father was teaching Sunday school, and so I remember that I was walking to the Sunday school, which took about 10 minutes through the acreage of fields, and so my family life was really confined to my parents and my father, essentially, and my mother.
So you mentioned the Communist Party. What was the presence of the Communist Party like in Germany at that time?
In Germany, the there were the Social Democrats, and the Nazis were there, and there were about five different parties, and they all emphasized the fact that there was a lot of unemployment at that time. There was many people had no food and no upbringing of any kind. And so that was the emphasis in my family.
And when did you first hear about the Nazi Party?
Oh, that was, if I remember correctly, that was in about 1933, when I was about 7 years old, that I first had heard that that the Nazis were an actual party. And I was I remember going to Nazi party without actually being a child, without actually being aware of the fact that they were Nazis, but they were. They told us stories, interesting stories about, for example, about the American Indians, and so therefore we had I became familiar with the Nazi Party as a child, with telling stories and adventure stories.
So were you even old enough to understand what their ideology was?
No, at the age of 6 or 7, I had no idea what their ideology was at that time. I learned much later what it was all about.
What was it like growing up in a political climate of extremism? There were the communists and the Nazis, which were both extreme in opposite ways, but there didn't seem to be a happy medium politically. What was that like?
Well, that was much later. I experienced the Nazi party only much later. And for example, I remember vividly a march my playmate suggested that that we should go to have to see one of those party marches. And I remember vividly that we saw suddenly two parties marching toward each other. And I remember that one of the parties was the Nazi party, and the other party was the Communist Party, where my friend's father was a member of. He was of the Communist Party, and so, and when the two columns approached each other, I was amazed to see that they suddenly beat each other up, and I was greatly surprised that would happen. But that was my first experience with the Communist Party, that they were beating each other up, the Nazis and the Communists, on the streets.
And were these adults or children? Were those adults or children?
No, they were all adults. They were, and we marched on the sidewalk, on the streets, as we accompanied the marchers. And then suddenly, as the two columns approached each other, they were very close to each other. So that's when they started beating each other up.
Were children at all involved with Hitler or the Nazi Party at that time?
Yeah, at that time they were the brown shirts, as we called them, the brown shirts, and then the blue shirts were the Catholic youth, and then the brown shirts were, of course, the Nazi Party. And the communists wore red shirts, so we could tell from the color of shirts that they wore. And that was our only involvement, really.
So were the brown shirts the Hitler Youth?
The brown shirts were the Hitler Youth, that's right.
And how did it evolve from its beginnings as a group of children reading adventure stories to what it eventually became?
Well, you have to understand that we were children, of course, and many of the adult world was just totally unfamiliar to us. So we saw that the adults behaved a certain way, and that the children, of course, the children groups, they were listening to adventure stories, which was totally different from what the adult world was like. So our child's world was totally separate, totally different. We didn't understand the adult world.
I learned from reading your book that participation in the Hitler Youth was mandated by a government decree. Can you tell me what that was like?
Well, the government decree was essentially the adult understanding of what the basic party was like. And among the Nazi parties, they emphasized the fact that a lot of the adults were without work, and then they didn't have any food to feed the families. And many of the, initially at least, when I was that young, that many of the poorness of the people, that the people were didn't have food, or they didn't have, couldn't send their children to school, and they didn't have appropriate clothing for the schools. So the Nazis emphasized the fact that Germany was very poor and needed to have some kind of government that would make it possible for people to have a decent living. That was the emphasis.
So you were forced to be involved with the Hitler Youth?
Well, I was forced in the sense that twice a week we marched through the streets, and that was when the Hitler Youth was the only youth that was available as an organization. At that time, Hitler had already taken over the government, and everything was Nazi government by that time. When I was about 7 or 8, the entire government was taken over by the Nazis, and there was nothing else available.
Did you ever enjoy your participation in the Hitler Youth?
Well, what we did enjoy was the marching through the neighborhood where we lived, and from the child's perspective, that was an experience that we liked, and we sang as a group, and we liked that. We also liked a little bit that we got to know the neighborhood where we didn't dare walk by ourselves, but as a group we could see the different areas.
So they made it pretty appealing to the children.
Yes, they're right, they did.
And what were your family's opinions regarding the Hitler propaganda?
Well, my parents initially were in favor of the overall government idea of supplying people with sufficient food and sufficient education, but they didn't like the incompatibility with the Christian viewpoint. They were they believed in Christ and in charity, which the Hitler Youth and the Hitler mentality was lacking.
Was there general agreement among the people of your community with the principles of the Nazi Party?
Well, the people, those people who had nothing before, they thought there was a very good measures that they had that now people had food and were given education. They liked that, and that was under and my parents liked it, that people had bread and had the basic needs of life. But they didn't like, of course, the basic understanding that the anti-Christian against the church and so on. These were the things that my parents didn't like.
Okay. And as you got older, what or who influenced your opinions about what was going on?
Well, when I saw my father the last time when I was 16 years old, and that the occasion was that we were commanded to go to have school at an anti-aircraft battery, and there we went into a suburban, actually it was a village area, country area where we were stationed. And I saw my father the last time when I was 16, when I came back to see him, he was actually gone. He was already drafted. He had been a soldier, and in the meanwhile I was in the anti-aircraft battery in the countryside, and that was very much like school. There was partly school. We had usually 4 or 5 hours of school, and then one day we had maybe English and Latin, and the next day we had math and physics and that sort of thing. So we really lived like soldiers. And during the night, many times we had the night attacks by airplanes, but we didn't have any direct bombardment of our particular battery.
So you said you were 16 when you went to the anti-aircraft battery.
That's correct. Yes, I was 16, and that's the last time I saw my father. And my father was killed in the war, and he never came back. He was in Austria when he was killed. We know only the area, but we don't know what happened in any detail.
Let's pause for just a second. We're back. So when did you first learn of the potential for war?
Well, the radio, at that time there was no television. The radio announced on a daily basis what happened in the war, or at least what the Nazis wanted us to know about the war. And there was a daily report after the war had started, and I remember when the war with France started, which was the first foreign war, France and England had started, and they reported what happened, the battles that happened, and the outcome of the battles. They said that usually, of course, what they mentioned was that the German troops were victorious, and that how many people were captured and how many soldiers were captured and this sort of thing.
How old were you at the time when you first learned about all of that?
The war started in 1933. So I was born in 1926, so 26 and 33, that's 7 years old, yeah.
Wow. So you were pretty young. So to what extent did you really understand what was going on?
Not very much, really. I'm sorry, the war, I made a mistake. I just reported, I said that the war started in Hitler took over in 1933.
Okay.
And the war started in 1939.
So you were still only 13?
Yeah.
That's still very young.
That's right, yeah. And much of it, I remember one time there was, when the war went bad in Russia, for example, I remember the people were asked to give warm clothing to the troops. And I remember that my parents, that was as my father was not drafted yet, that everybody gave some warm clothes, winter coats and things like that, and gloves that the troops didn't have. And we were so greatly surprised at the fact that Hitler was completely unprepared for having the war in the wintertime in Russia, which was then in Russia. And that Hitler hadn't made any provisions for that.
It was too cold for the soldiers,
right?
It was
very cold, yeah.
So it sounds like your parents were very philanthropic people.
Yes, they were. There was part of their Christian religion that they were. Part of the problem was, of course, that many of the people who disappeared in concentration camps, that many of them were Christians who made a big issue out of the fact that they disagreed with the Nazis. And the favorite way of the Nazis to handle these people was to have them disappear in concentration camps.
Do you think your parents felt torn between wanting to defend their beliefs versus the threats?
My parents know that if they officially said anything against the Nazis, that they would wind up in concentration camps. So they were very disappointed of how things turned out eventually. And of course, the fact that Germany lost the war was really the Nazis' fault. And the fact that they started a war that was not winnable, because, I mean, the whole world was against the Nazis and against the what they called Weltanschauung, the general attitude of the people.
That's a German word?
The attitude, I'm sorry.
That's a German word that you just mentioned?
Oh, the general attitude? I don't remember mentioning it, Joe. I'm sorry. I didn't realize that. Sometimes I switch into German. I don't realize it. I'm sorry. I mentioned a German word. It'd be hard to remember for somebody who doesn't speak German.
Yes. So how did your parents feel about the anti-Semitic propaganda that was going on?
Well, they thought there was no real reason. They knew Jewish people, for example, from before. They thought it was terrible that Hitler really made him. There was no reason for doing to the Jews what was done to them. If my parents had said anything to the fact that what they really believed in, they would have disappeared in a concentration camp and they wouldn't have accomplished anything.
So it was kind of pointless since the government was so powerful, right?
That's exactly right. And the government, the SS troopers, for example, they were the fanatics in many ways. In fact, some of my classmates were fanatical Nazis, and they believed everything that the Nazis told them, and there was clearly a separation in our class already, and that extended all the way into the war and into the after war.
How do you think you kept from getting sucked into that?
Well, we just kept silent and didn't officially protest against the Nazis. If we had we would have disappeared in concentration camps, and we know that that's what would happen, and we wouldn't have accomplished anything.
That's definitely not ideal. What were the immediate consequences that you remember resulting from the outbreak of the war?
The immediate consequences? Well, as you know, the war began in France, and Germany was victorious against France, and later on the real loss when Germany lost the war was and when many German soldiers were lost was Stalingrad, for example, where I've forgotten how many millions of soldiers were captured by the Russians. And many of them died because they didn't have enough food, or it was because of the cold climate.
So initially the war was fought only in surrounding countries, so you weren't in the midst of it, is that correct?
That's
right away.
Well,
right
the only
beginning.
Thing that we experienced was, of course, bombing during the night. Many times as a youngster, I sat in the what they did is in the basements of all the homes, they built bomb shelters. And I remember in our we lived in an apartment building, and the bomb shelter was consisted of one basement area where we as soon as the sirens sounded, we knew that there was a bombing operation underway, and so we ran down into the basement with our warmest clothes on. And so we knew about the war from our basement experience. And frequently we talked about what happened in the different fronts and how many soldiers were killed and this sort of thing.
So would you say you kept up with the progress of the war?
Yeah, we exchanged the news that how far the German troops advanced into foreign territory. Many of the news that came through the newspaper and through the radio, which was the main area of communication, that we knew pretty much what went on.
When did the war actually start to feel real as opposed to a more distant conflict?
Well, the war felt real. I would say real was when I became an anti-aircraft helper. When we had uniforms and we moved on out into the area where the cannons were, and I was trained to adjust the height of the cannon, and then of course when the first shots were fired, that was my personal war experience. Of course, later on I experienced a lot more when I became a real soldier. This was just, we were pupils, we were in school when this happened, when we were in the, that was about 6 months that we stayed in the camp, in the anti-aircraft camp. Or we had to continue to have school.
So was your father drafted before that?
Yes, my father was my father was drafted when I was 16 and was in the train station. That's when I last saw him. When he became a soldier, a German soldier, at the time when I was 13, when I was in the anti-aircraft camp. And that's when he became a soldier.
So after he was drafted, did you consider the possibility that you might be drafted too after that?
No, I was drafted. I became a German. I had volunteered for the Air Force because, and I was immediately transferred to France, and I learned a little bit about France and from the train aspect, and I was in Angers, which was the first city where I was stationed, and we were trained to be infantry soldiers at that time in Angers. And then later on, of course, at the very end, I moved into toward the Eastern Front, and I was trained to be an electronic technician in the Air Force. And I spent in southern Germany. I was transferred from France directly to Germany. And a lot of the people who were aircraft soldiers were pilots and different and board trained mechanics, and there were some of them were just I don't know how to say it in German, in English. They were trained to have machine guns, really what it boiled down to. Machine guns in airplanes.
You said before that there were a lot of students at the anti-aircraft battery, right?
Yes, they were all students.
And how was it determined which students were made to attend classes at the anti-aircraft battery?
Well, in the morning, we just all attended if there was no attack by the British or American Air Force. If there was no attack, then we all attended schools. So, and we had these different classes on different days, and there was pretty much all uniform.
What was it like leaving your family for that?
It was very hard, of course. We were school children there, and we were transported to the countryside where the anti-aircraft battery was located. And so we became soldiers. We were right next to our battery. There were six or eight young soldiers, really students, who were in one barrack, like a military barrack, and then we lived there. And when there was an attack by American or British airplanes, we ran to the cannons, and my job was to adjust the height of the cannon, the angle of the height, which was always directly overhead, Soldiers or students were trained to move the cannon in an area around 360 degrees, and others were adjusted the distance. And the way we did this was we superimpose the electronic signal with the mechanical signal, which was in a big black box direct in front of one of us.
Did you find your responsibilities difficult at all, or did they come naturally to you?
Well, we had no real choice, and the difficult part was that the only adult that we had was they had to have a strong man who would stuff the ammunition into the cannon itself. And so the only area we had was so we had all these different areas and different functions, and the different functions were just set. So but the basic function was that we had to superimpose arrows that we had to turn, which were direct electric signals transformed into a mechanical signal, and that's the best I can explain it.
Okay. How were you treated by your superiors?
We were like typical soldiers. We were punished, for example, if we laughed when it was inappropriate, for example. Or I remember one time when we didn't feel like we would feel like carrying out orders, then the whole company, all of us Air Force helpers, were had to run and then march and fall to the ground and that sort of thing. So we were punished for behavior, like we were not going just to follow the orders. But so, and I remember that very distinctly, that how we were punished for not following orders.
What was the transition like from your training to actual fighting?
We were sort of shocked the very first time when we heard the loud blast from the cannons. We weren't used to that. I mean, it was an enormous noise, and then here there were six other cannons directly around us, and so to hear the blast of all the cannons was. I remember one time I shot part of the top wall off with our cannon, and fortunately our corporal who was in charge of us helped me hide it, because we put the bricks back in. And but that was the noise level was just absolutely incredible. And initially our urge was to run away from it all, but we had no choice. We were in a wall about 5 feet high, so we couldn't really run away. we would have to climb up at a wall, and there was nothing but noise on the other side of the wall.
So what happened after your time at the anti-aircraft battery?
Well, when I came back home, I had to go back to what they call pre-semester, where the education continued, and we had to see, since we missed some of the school, the last year in school, high school, so we had to do pre-semester, as they called it. And so when I came back after the war, we resumed school, and
so what happened after your pre-semester?
Were you sent anywhere else? I had to take examination to see if how well we knew physics and all the other different things for different university careers. And so we took the examinations. There were written examinations. And I was very fortunate that I was admitted back to medical school. And that was only after several different examinations.
And I recall from your book that you were inducted into the Air Force also, right?
Only during the war.
Right.
Yeah, during the war. And I was not in the post-war Air Force.
Right. Mm-hmm. So your military career ended when the war ended.
That's right.
But when you were in the Air Force, what was your ranking?
I was buck private until the very end. And it all started in, I had this episode in where I failed to give a military greeting to one of the officers on one of the islands in Usedom, which is in the East Sea. Because of that, I was taken to a military officer who had to punish me, and one of the punishments was that I could not be promoted.
And how did you feel about that?
Well, since I didn't like the war anyway, so I didn't mind not being promoted.
You didn't have any military aspirations?
No.
So it didn't really matter, did it?
No, that's right, it didn't matter. But that's was the reason why I was never promoted to even private.
Was there anyone who you worked with or any of your superiors who you found particularly memorable from that time?
Well, we constantly changed. About every few weeks we were in a different location with different people, different officers. And I was very impressed with one of the, in France, with one of the, not officers, but the intermediate rank in France. He was a very, very nice man. He felt with us, and he worked with us, and he was about the only one who ever really understood us and who we could be frank with and honest how we felt about the war, who understood how we felt. But he was, I saw him later on back in Frankfurt, actually, where we appreciated each other and after all the experience we had. But he was in France, and one time he had he had a French lady with him in the motorcycle, and we greatly admired him, the fact that he didn't conform to the official behavior that and everybody else followed.
He sounds like a unique individual to be found in the military.
Yeah, he really was. He was a very humane kind of person who we appreciated.
And you met him in France?
In Frankfurt, yeah.
Oh, Frankfurt.
Yeah, I heard that there was a whole regiment was being discharged, and I heard through a friend of mine that group was being discharged, and that's how I met him.
Did you work with him in France initially?
No.
Were you ever in France during your time
in Frankfurt,
serving in the war in France?
Oh, in France, yes. Mm-hmm. Yes, I spent about 3 months in France in two different areas. The first was in Angers, and the second 8 weeks was in Bordeaux, or in wine country.
And what were your responsibilities while you were in France?
Well, I was there as a soldier, only as a soldier. After the basic training in infantry, we had to watch and an Air Force station that we had to watch. And one time we experienced the fact that that some of the Frenchmen attacked the station of the and then so we were awakened in the middle of the night, and finally they disappeared, and we don't know what happened to them. That was in France.
Okay. And I understand that during your time in France, you were presented with information about options for careers in the Air Force. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct.
And for what careers were you eligible or ineligible?
Well, I was totally disinterested in, I just wanted to survive the war. And I was totally disinterested in anything having to do. I had early decided I wanted to study medicine, and I was totally disinterested in anything that the active service would have offered me.
So did you find any alternative options that that would be a little more relevant to your interests?
Not really, no. During the war years, I mean, you know, that was all one experience, and France and Germany and whatever. And then, as I've said in my book, toward the end of the war, I experienced the end of the war. As such, being taken prisoner for POW at the age of 18 and 19, I escaped from the German troops, and had my own experience, as I've described in the book.
So how did you end up being a prisoner of war?
When the war ended and I escaped all by myself as an individual away from the Russian front. I was stationed in East Germany in the Russian front, and after I escaped all by myself after the whole front, the Eastern Front, dissolved, and I became a POW in a small American camp initially, and then in a larger British camp.
How did that experience impact you, would you say?
How did that experience affect me? I was very fortunate that I didn't become prisoner again, like some of the people who wound up in French factories and various situations in France. They had the hope that they would be discharged home, but I was fortunate that I was in the American zone. You know, after the war, the zones were divided into French, which was southeastern Germany, southwestern Germany, and American zone, which was in the center, and the British zone, which was northern Germany. And so after I was discharged home, I was in a British prison camp, and they discharged us home, and then I resumed the private civil. I became a student, you know, and all of that.
What were conditions like in the prison camp?
Well, initially, when I became a first POW, we had very little food, and we were really starving. That was because the British soldiers didn't have that much food. And initially, we spent the time repairing roads that had been bombed, and fill in the craters for the bombing. And I was in the British prison camp for about 6 months or so. And I was very fortunate in that my mother had put some clothes away, because Frankfurt was bombed heavily. She put some clothes away for me that I could, civilian clothes that other than my uniform, so that when I was in, she put this away in my grandmother's house, and so I was very fortunate that I had those clothes available, because many times if soldiers came back home in their uniform, they were captured by the usually British or American troops, and they were put again in prison camp. And I, since I had this these clothes for my mother, I was able to avoid that. I just went home because, well.
That was very smart of her to do that for you. Can you tell me about your discharge?
The discharge was, was a very typical discharge because they put anti-insect powder into our pants and in our shirts, and we had to do that in order to not have lice and fleas, which we had from the prison camp. And I got discharge papers that were useful in the American zone, and everybody was sent home to the American. First, the people who were in the British zone, northern Germany, were discharged first, and then the people who were in the American zone were discharged last, or the French zone were discharged last. And we had all the discharge papers and were given those papers and sent home.
How were you sent home?
Since I was in the Air Force, they had our arms raised to make sure that they didn't have any discharge, any SS troopers, because the SS troopers had under their armpits had marks that they wanted to, they would not allow any of the people with those marks to get discharge papers. So that was to just prevent SS troopers from going home. Discharge on.
And did they put you on a train after that?
Yes, we went on a train from the British occupied zone to the American zone. And I was fortunate that we went by that place where my mother had sent clothing for the discharge. And because that was happened to be on the railroad station right where my mother had sent the clothing, and so that's why I was able to see my grandmother and spend a few days there before I actually went home to Frankfurt.
And that wasn't the ultimate destination of the train, was it?
No, that's right. It was the train was. I just jumped off the train and walked to my grandmother's house.
And did any other discharge soldiers have the same idea to get off of the train?
Yes, they did. Some of them did. Thought that they could get away with their uniforms, and they got off the train in their uniforms and then were recaptured and not sent home.
So after you stopped at your grandmother's, you went back to Frankfurt, right?
Yes.
What was it like to return to your hometown? Finally.
Well, there was all. It was there were lots of houses were bombed and had were destroyed, and The whole place was just pretty much after the war, post-war destruction. And as I've said before, my father never did return.
Sorry to hear that. How was your mother doing at that point?
Yeah, you know, my mother was very surprised to see me, and you know, of course she cried. She hadn't seen me in 2 years, over 2 years, and I had never had any vacation, official leave from the military, and she knew I wanted to study medicine, and she did everything she could to help me with getting started with medicine.
2 years, that's a long time.
I'm sorry?
2 years, that's a long time.
Yes,
to be gone. What was your transition back to civilian life like?
Well, I just was very fortunate. I have had a pre-semester. I was very fortunate I passed all the examinations, and then I went into medical school in Frankfurt, which is a huge, gigantic hospital, and all the pre-medical subjects, chemistry and so on, and anatomy that were taught there. So that was very fortunate that everything was still intact, all the buildings were intact, and I met several interesting people when we met at the area of reconstruction of the buildings.
So the war was over.
Yes.
At this point. In chapter 4 of your book, you said, "I wasn't cut out to be a hero." What did you mean by that?
Well, I wasn't. I wasn't interested in the war. And what I meant by that was that I was not made to be a soldier, that I had the mentality of a soldier. I disliked the war and all the things that came with it.
So at this point, you're pretty much beginning an entirely new stage of your life.
Yes.
Entering the medical field and continuing your studies, right?
Yeah, and then an opportunity to, if I hadn't been accepted in the medical school in Frankfurt, I would have been able to go to, by sheer luck, I would have been able to go to Heidelberg, because I knew the. I had, that's another story, that I met a Jewish fellow who lived in Frankfurt, and he told me that he was Jewish, and so I told him that it didn't make any difference to me whether he was Jewish or whatever he was. So we kept up our friendship, which at the time was questionable, because you might have been put in a concentration camp if you had been with a Jewish person and had a. So anyway, the after the war was over, my mother called me one time and said, "Klaus Weil is back here." That was his name, and so the parents were very kind to me, it turned out that his father was chairman of orthopedic surgery, and he would have helped me get into the medical school in Heidelberg if I hadn't been accepted in Frankfurt. So that was very, and they invited me on vacations and were very kind to me.
But you ended up going to medical school in Frankfurt, not Heidelberg.
No, right? I went to Frankfurt. Yeah.
So what were the next steps in your academic career?
Well, I after I graduated from medical school, I immigrated to the United States, to Canada, and I did an internship in Canada, a rotating internship, and took my state board examination there. In order to, I had intended to practice in Canada. The reason I picked Canada rather than the United States was because the Canadians offered after passing an internship that one could, as a foreign graduate, that one could practice and take the examination, the same examinations that the Canadian citizens take. So I did that once I had settled in. I moved to Chicago, and after the first year after I passed the rotating internship, and then I took my state board examinations in Canada in order to, because I had at that time wanted to practice in Canada, and I took my state board examination in Canada.
Where did
in Toronto?
Oh, okay. Originally, where did the idea to immigrate come from?
Well, originally, my father was born and raised in Philadelphia. And my father always had an open mind to immigrate into the United States or Canada. And well, since my dad was born and raised in Philadelphia, and his older sister had also been born there, and they had gone to school, and I've seen little picture books that they did together, his older sister and he, and so therefore the idea of immigrating to the States was never a strange thought to me.
Because of the family background?
Family, yeah.
Did you consider any other options besides Canada or the United States?
Yes, we did. I met a medical student, Dieter Kirchheim was his name, and he too was, his parents were in South Africa, in German South Africa, and he was very gung-ho for immigrating, and he helped me actually. I helped him in the examination because he had to work in with the U.S. occupation force, and he was able to, he always kept the idea awake of immigrating to the United States because his parents were also had lived in German South Africa and for the immigrating type.
So did you decide to go together at the same time?
Yes, actually, he had some American money which I didn't have, and he helped pay for the railroad trip, for example, to Montreal, actually to Ottawa. And that's where we met again, and he let me stay and sleep in his internship quarters. And So that helped me a lot, being able to sleep there. I had no money for the emigration.
So besides the money, were there any other roadblocks in your emigration plan, or did everything go pretty smoothly?
Well, other than just, again, the usual state board examinations, and I had in Chicago, I had my fourth set of state board examinations. I met my wife in Chicago, and after we decided to get married, then we went to, I had special examinations and special state board examinations in Canada. And we decided then, since she was from Chicago, that we would return to Chicago. And that's where our careers continued. I had to take the state board examinations again. And we decided to settle in Chicago. And after I practiced there, I sort of got the Wanderlust. I wanted to have some research experience, and I wanted to practice research as well as clinical practice. So I took state board examinations in Florida, and decided to settle here in Florida.
So how did you choose Florida?
Well, I was accepted. I passed the state board examination and was accepted on the faculty at the University of Florida.
And what was your, what did your faculty position consist of?
I started out as assistant professor and then worked my way up to full professor by doing clinical work and research work. And I discovered that animals became addicted to alcohol and used that method which helped me to become full professor.
So that's quite an accomplishment.
Thank you, yes. So that's a long story.
So what was your specialization as a physician?
My wife and I went to Montreal, where I took specialty boards in endocrinology. That was the purpose of moving to Montreal for a couple of years. And that's when I had the state boards.
What was your main research interest?
In endocrinology, gland biochemistry. I got a master's of biochemistry in Montreal, and after that, I specialized in endocrinology, disease of glands. Well, that's it, huh?
Well, did you have anything that you wanted to add about your experience at the University of Florida? at the medical school?
No, it was a very good experience, and your mom grew up here, and after we were able to buy a house, we bought this house here. We're still in it, and made a career out of Florida.
So you came to the University of Florida in Gainesville in what year, approximately?
That was in 63 was the year we came here, and initially I was doing work with Dr. Thomas, who hired me, and I became associate director of the Clinical Research Center, and I spent a lot of my time at the Clinical Research Center as director.
Wow.
And that was an interesting job. It was just what I wanted.
Did you have any other involvement with the university? Or any other positions that you took on?
No, just the usual things. You're assistant professor and then associate professor and then become full professor. And each time you're being evaluated by peers. And I was fortunate that the chairman of pharmacology, they're usually biochemists, was chairman of the promotion committee, and he said, I don't see how I found out 30 years later that he said, he has made so many contributions and so on, the usual. He stood up for me because it was mostly biochemists who he thought that my contributions were very worthwhile. So
that's high praise.
I'm sorry?
That's high praise.
Yeah.
And if I recall correctly, you once said you were involved with the Faculty Senate also?
Yeah, I was chairman of the Animal Committee for about 10 years or so. We had to make sure that the animals were treated humanely and that they weren't exposed to all kinds of things that were not acceptable. So I was chairman of the Animal Care Committee, and boy, there's so many years that I've done that. There were about 10 years, which was a lot of administrative work, which I really wasn't cut out for. I learned after I came here that I had to, that I could not ask my employees to work on weekends.
Oh.
And so I had to actually, except under very, very special circumstances, I had to feed the animals myself. There were special liquids that had to be fed for this purpose. And so I had to come in and do all of this myself.
And this was your research lab?
Yeah.
At the university?
I had two labs, actually. And, of course, animal quarters. That had to be taken care of.
And in your medical career, did you prefer teaching or research or working with patients?
Well, I actually had to do all three factors. I had to, and I enjoyed doing all three things. They expected, the reason I was sent to Germany for 3 months was because I attracted a lot of money from the National Institute of Health. And the chairman, Dr. Clough, was very kind and appreciative of the fact that, you know, they got big money to fund my research establishment. So that was part of the success that's what is expected of you, that you are all around, that you perform in all three areas. Teaching, I mean, I taught physical diagnosis class, and in fact, your father, the first time I met your father was when I had to explain of the meaning of the research of your father, that your father had done. And I met all your family. I met your uncle and the whole family. That I met them all, you know. I explained to them what the meaning of your father's research was. That was my function. And I mean, so I had a lot of different functions. I mean, research, teaching. I taught physical diagnosis class for many years. In fact, I have my current physician, my own personal physician is, I had him first in as an intern and then as a resident.
And, so that kind of came full circle.
Yeah, full circle, that's why.
And when did you retire?
About 10 years ago. And I met our current physician as a resident. And I had a different physician first. And boy, he didn't perform very well. I was sitting there with high fever, shaking in his office, which was one of these buildings north of here. And I was not impressed that he was. I was impressed initially, yeah, but it didn't work out.
So your current status is Professor Emeritus, right?
Uh-huh.
At the university. And are you still involved with the university in any ways?
Not really.
Retired faculty.
I get an enormous number of research of medications. I mean, the drug industry, I've just been overwhelmed with advertisements from the drug industry. and
like you in know, your email inbox.
An internist, yeah. Being an internist, and that's the reason why I have given up my university address finally. It's I've spent so much time just dealing with the drug advertisements. It's just overwhelming. Well,
so, I think
we're finished, aren't we?
Unless you have anything to add.
No, I pretty much describe it all in the book.
And the title of your book is?
You want me to have it?
The title of your book. Can you say it?
You mean
The Sun Kept Rising.
The Sun Kept Rising.
Yeah.
Yeah, the title of the book there were, yeah.
How did you come up with that title for your memoirs?
Well, every time something seemed to go wrong or seemed to go down, I always found something that the sun kept rising. That at the last moment, some solution came up, or it was a real success. I mean, you know, I, from being a prisoner, POW, to everything, always it fell into place, and I've been very fortunate. I have to say that so many people helped me always. That was maybe the critical thing, that so many people helped me for no, they got nothing out of it. I mean, you know.
Selfless acts.
Yeah.
All right. Do you have anything else to add?
No.
All right. Well, I guess we can conclude with that. Thank you for your time.
Oh, you're quite welcome.